Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about the finale, episode 12 in our current series, The State versus Greg Lance. That episode is called The Man Who Knew Too Much. And if you haven't heard it yet, go back and listen. It is a doozy. We will be here when you get back. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and one of the audio editors for Undisclosed. And with me today is Rabia Chaudhry, the New York Times best-selling author of Adnan's story and the lead reporter on this Greg Lance series. Hello, Rabia.
Hey, Rebecca. I just learned how to unmute myself. I'm good.
That's good to know. 12 episodes in and you finally figured it out. Also with us is Colin Miller. He's a professor and dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law and the blogger behind the Evidence Prof blog and my favorite legal series. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How's it going?
It's going well. And Susan Simpson, we should say, will be joining us in a few minutes. So we will just wait for her to arrive and talk in the meantime. So I'm going to start with a synopsis of this episode. Robbie, as you know, it was a long one and a lot happened, a lot of mic drop moments. So I'm just going to give it a quick synopsis and then we can talk about it. In the season finale of the Greg Lance case, we begin by learning more about the murder weapon and the investigation to trace it after it reached Robert Shepard's possession. We also learn about the various witnesses who connected the murder weapon to Sam Horn, having seen it in his possession and even fired it themselves. Sam himself seems to have given away his connection to the weapon by drawing a similar-looking one for the police the day after they found the gun on the Bohannon farm. We hear more from Lacey Harness, who provides some details that indicate he was likely at the Kalashnikov house the night of the murders. He and his sister Jenny also mention an antique gas can that Peggy Horn snatched away from an investigator, which matched pictures of an old red metal gas can in the evidence file that were inexplicable until now. In the years since his conviction, Greg began the long appellate fight as his mother and advocate Linda kept searching for more evidence. In 2015, they received records from the state bomb and arson division that included a receipt for a shirt found at the crime scene the day after the murders and turned into Putnam County officers by the victim's son, Sergey Lebed. This shirt was never disclosed to the defense, but corroborates statements from multiple people as far back as 1999 that Peggy Horn kept mentioning she left behind a shirt during the ramblings. They also shockingly discovered that Greg's own attorney was representing an incarcerated witness who could have helped Greg's defense, but never disclosed it to anyone, although the prosecutor knew about it. That witness never testified for Greg because attorney Marshall Judd instead helped him use the information to try and get a better deal from authorities. Finally, we learn what happened in Greg's personal life after his conviction. His wife Becky filed for divorce and remarried, but was killed in a car accident in 2012. From behind bars, Greg was forced to fight a court battle to keep his parental rights for Rebecca, which he succeeded at. He met Jara Sofer, who was involved with him personally and in his case for 6 years, but wasn't able to stay the course. The episode ends with the possible avenues of relief for Greg and information about where the Horns are today. Now, I just really want to get to something that I know a lot of listeners want to know about and I want to know about. And it may not be at the top of the list of bullet points that I have in front of me, but I can't stop thinking about it. Sam Horn, why was he so untouchable? Are there theories about that? Was he an informant? Was he like serving some other purpose in law enforcement in this community? Do we know the answer to that question?
I don't think anybody knows for sure the answer to that question. People who knew Sam had different theories about it because they were also kind of incredulous. You know, as meth heads themselves, they would get freaked out when the police would show up. I spoke to one witness. Well, one witness told us that he remembered a time when they had some meth in the car. He was in a car with Sam and they had some meth. And the sheriff, Sheriff Jerry Abston, whose son is now the sheriff, apparently, pulled up, and this guy was like, "That's it. We're going to jail. We're in big trouble. We're screwed." Sam gets out of the car, goes over to Jerry, and just has a conversation like they're buddies, gets back in his car and goes back to doing whatever they're doing. And again, repeatedly, people have told us that they've seen police officers, not TBI, but I think local Putnam County officers at Sam's house as he's cooking meth. I don't know. Either he was a confidential informant or there was some kickback going in towards, I mean, like maybe some people were in on it, or maybe some of these cops got their own drugs from him. You know, we talked earlier in an episode about how, you know, there's reason to believe that maybe the district attorney, General Gibson, might have had a cocaine problem. It's interesting. You know, remember that clip that we played from YouTube in which he says, you know, I've never done cocaine. Well, he went on after he was disbarred to become the executive director of a say no to drugs type of organization. Hmm. And I think that kind of thing happens when you have some kind of personal interest or experience. You know, he's very committed to drug rehabilitation now in his latest career.
Colin, when you were first working on this series and you were, you know, getting the information from Rabia and sort of you're figuring out how these episodes would go, did you imagine that by this point in the series, there would be so much, I mean, it's seemingly like real evidence pointing to like an alternative theory of the crime and alternative suspects in the crime? I'm really flabbergasted by that myself.
Yeah, I mean, the goal with most of these series is just to look at the state's case against the person who's been convicted and to figure out, is this a wrongful conviction? Can we sort of undermine the evidence of guilt that was presented at trial? And so, no, by no means did I expect that by the end of the series, we would have landed here and have such strong evidence that points in another direction, in a specific direction. So that is certainly a great surprise to me.
So, Rabia, why did the defense investigator, Harcum, who we meet in the podcast, think that this guy Shepard, you know, the original gun possessor, is the key to this case? Did he have theories about how that gun got into Sam Horn's hands, potentially?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I spoke to Mr. Harcum, he became a private investigator after 36 years with the FBI, and he knew Shepard from before. He still knows Shepard. I mean, they live in the same town. And he said to me that before he began working on this case, he had lots of interactions with Shepard, so he kind of just knew Shepard. And one of the questions I asked him, I said, is Shepard the kind of person where we should believe what he tells you? And he's like, absolutely not. And I also asked him, was it possible that Shepard, being somebody who trades guns, that maybe he lost track of that gun? And he's like, absolutely not. The fact that he was able to establish that Shepard got that gun pretty close in time to the murders, like within the year before the murders, which another witness also had said that before, he just doesn't believe that within that year he lost track of the gun. And, you know, when I spoke to Shepard, when I would say, I asked him a couple different ways about whether he knew Sam, whether he knew anything about Sam, whether he had heard rumors about Sam. He was so curt. He was just like, no, no. Mm-hmm. No, like there's no, he just didn't want to go there. I mean, everybody believes Shepard knows where the gun went. I also think it's kind of weird that the police are like, well, I guess he doesn't know. We just let it go. Like, make no effort to try to figure it out after that.
What was that drawing all about? It was very good. Like a drawing drawn by Sam Horn. Of the murder,
so
like,
weird.
Why was that in? Like, how did that come to be? Were they like, here's a gun. Can you draw a picture of it, Sam? Like, what was the origin story behind that?
So that document was produced in discovery. We have not been able to figure out. Greg believes that someone told him that Sam went to the police station the next morning, the day after the gun was found, and drew it for them. But he doesn't know where in 20 years, he doesn't remember who told him where that, he's not sure why he believes that. There's nothing in the document itself that tells us where this interview was taken or where he was. And I have no idea. So have you guys taken a look at the picture?
Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I have a theory.
Okay.
It's kind of dumb. My theory is that Sam heard the gun had been found somehow and he wanted it back. And this was his way of like claiming it. And like, it was like, well, what does it look like? And so I had to draw a picture of it.
Why would he want it back if he knew he murdered people with
Well,
it?
Maybe he thought he could. I don't, because he's like, I don't think that he thought he was in the frame for the murder, right? I mean, it didn't seem like they were ever like, despite all of the stuff surrounding them, he seemed pretty confident nothing bad would happen. I just couldn't think of any other reason why someone would draw a picture of a gun, unless it was like, have you seen somebody holding a gun and what did it look like? But there's nothing in there that says that. I don't know, Colin, what do you think? What do you think of my theory that like he thought he could just get this thing back like it was in Lost and Found?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we often break down these cases and try to think, well, why would a reasonable person do that? And then you look online every single day about really dumb things that criminals do. And so, I mean, it certainly could be his thinking. I wouldn't second guess your sort of assumption there about what might have happened. It could be any number of things. But yeah, these people often don't make logical decisions that you can sort of rationally break down.
I mean, look, here's the thing. This is what I think about that in terms of a theory. If that was the case, then I don't know why he would deflect it to Claude Wright. He would just say, this is my gun.
Right.
The other thing is this, though, while it's true that Sam seemed to be like total rubber when it came to a lot of stuff, in the weeks after the murders, him and his wife and the Redmond family completely left. Like 2 days later, they moved off their properties completely. They never came back. Sam, Samantha and Peggy left, went to the Cleghorns for like weeks. That he was freaked out that they're coming, and he had told you know, Jackie and Billy remembered Sam just always having guns and just sitting on the couch saying, they're gonna come after me and I'll be ready for them when the police come. So he was a little freaked out. He definitely was alerted when the gun was found, because we found out that Bohannon, who owned that, that he, him and Sam went back for a long time. So Bohannon probably just told him. And you know, people, word gets around, it's just a little town, it's, they're on the same street.
Yeah.
Tsunamis, volcanoes, tornadoes, earthquakes. These are real-life monsters. We like to think we're prepared for a catastrophe, but time and again, Mother Nature proves us wrong. Each week, the Parcast Network's new podcast, Natural Disasters, investigates the Earth's most devastating catastrophes and explores the stories of the people impacted by it. Some of these natural disasters are ancient and shrouded in mystery, like the volcanic eruption of Mount Vesuvius, where it's believed that 16,000 people died due to heat and suffocation. Others are more recent, like the 8 climbers who were caught in a terrible blizzard in 1996 as they attempted to scale Mount Everest, or a 2011 tsunami that killed an estimated 18,000 people in Japan, with waves reported as 3 stories high. Natural disasters remind us that despite humanity's achievements, we're no match for the fury of Mother Nature. Listen and subscribe to Natural Disasters for free on Spotify and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
So we heard that the Horns were subpoenaed for Greg's trial and actually appeared in court, but that Joyce saw their lawyer, the Horns' lawyer, tell them to leave. Colin, do you have thoughts about that? Because I have no idea, like, how, I mean, right? These were alternative suspects, right? Like, why could they just get off the hook from after being subpoenaed and just be told to leave? Do you have any sense of what that could be?
Well, this is so, as far as I know, Robbie, right, the Greg's mother wanted them to be subpoenaed, and that's really the only reason the defense counsel subpoenaed them.
Yeah.
And then when you're seeing their attorney saying you can leave, what that typically would mean in a case is that the defense has indicated after these people have been subpoenaed and appeared, we're not going to call them to testify, and then that's relayed to their attorney who tells them they can leave. And so, you know, my sense, and Robbie might have more insight, is that this is something defense counsel never wanted to do. They just sort of did it to placate the mother, and then, of course, never followed through because they never had a plan to actually call them as witnesses at trial.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They had absolutely no intention of calling the Horns. Joyce had to fight with them, and she's told me, I had to hold my ground and say, this is non-negotiable. You're going to subpoena them. So they did. But here's my question, Colin. Do you think, why would the defense counsel, or why would they not want to call them? Do you think it's just because they didn't think it would, do you think that was the right call on their part?
I mean, it's tough to say without knowing 100% what they knew at that time. Now, in hindsight, with everything we have now, of course, it would make sense because there's a lot of strong evidence that could be used in association with them. I'm not sure at the time exactly what they knew and what they were thinking. But yeah, in hindsight, it doesn't seem to make much sense in the moment. I can't really say.
I mean, they had Billy's statements. They had Paula's statements, and they didn't subpoena Paula either. They had Chris Henry's statements. Chris is the guy who said, I fired Sam's Tech 9. They didn't call him either. I just think they did a piss poor job.
Well, so, I mean, you know, the question you always have with this is, you know, if you are an attorney, you have two options when you have at least some evidence pointing in the direction of alternate suspects. One is you are trying to attack the state's case and essentially say, like, the two options are Greg Lance is guilty or some other person, we don't know who, is guilty of this crime. The other is to actually present the evidence you have pointing to the alternate suspects. And the concern that attorneys always have in that case is, do I have enough evidence? Because what the jury might do in that scenario is to say, compare Greg Lance's possible guilt to the alternate suspect's possible guilt. And if the evidence pointing toward Greg Lance is stronger, they're going to convict, whereas they wouldn't necessarily do that if it's just, is he guilty or not, with no alternate suspects there. So it's a tough call to make in these types of cases.
Hmm. And joining us now, I hear, is Susan Simpson, a Washington-based attorney and the blogger behind The View from LL2 and brand newly minted political talking head on cable TV. Hello, Susan, and congratulations
on
your...
a pundit.
I'm not surprised at all that your telephone record detective work has led you to this point. Do you want to just, for listeners who don't know, do you want to just explain why it is you're like all over my TV these days?
Because impeachment is like all the news there is now. And I wrote an article for Just Security, if you want to check it out, on the quid pro quo call involving Ambassador Sondland. Yeah.
And you
basically,
were right.
Susan caught something that nobody else, like in the entire intelligence community, caught.
Right.
Right. Related to cell phone records.
No surprise there. And then what you caught seems to be underscored by the committee report that came out, that the single call seems to be correct. So you were right. So I look forward to what else you're going to be digging up in the next few days and seeing you on my TV talking about it. But you're just in time to answer a question that I have some concerns around. And this is the ethical issues raised with Greg Lance's attorney, who apparently was also representing a potentially exculpatory witness at the same time and didn't tell anyone, but apparently the prosecution knew. WTF, Susan Simpson, what are your thoughts on that?
WTF kind of sums it up. You can't do that, by the way, just to all the attorneys out there.
Explain
FYI,
why.
Don't
because
do
not everyone's an attorney, so explain why that's not okay.
There are times where it might be ethically okay for an attorney to represent defendants that have encountered one another or have some interaction in the legal system of some sort. So it's not like a blanket rule. Like if you represent one person, everyone else connected to them in any way is now off limits. However, in this case, the conflict is very clear. He has two clients looking for a deal potentially. And one of them has information that could be relevant to his own sentencing, but it's also relevant to the other one's case. And there's no way in advance the attorney can know that he can represent both clients' interests simultaneously and not have one of them get screwed over.
This is a model rule of professional conduct 1.7 that covers this. Yeah. And so essentially that is exactly what Susan just described there. Yeah.
Well, in the civilian world, I mean, I know one thing that one can do, not in the criminal system, but like in the, you know, civilian legal system, like family court and stuff, is if, for instance, you are in a dispute with your ex or your soon-to-be ex and you're worried that they're going to hire a super scary lawyer that you don't want to go up against, like, you can call that lawyer and have a conversation with them and then they'll be, like, conflicted out of representing your ex.
You can, but you can't.
Right, you can, but you can't. But there's, like, in very, like, relatable ways that explains why this wouldn't work, right? So if you talk to one lawyer about, you know, my husband is really trying to do X, Y, Z, and then you end up going with another lawyer, hiring somebody different. Like, that first lawyer can't represent your ex-husband because they'll know stuff that you told them, and it would be a big conflict. And I guess when I heard this, the thing that really stuck out to me was the fact that the prosecution knew, and they didn't disclose it. Are they obligated to disclose that kind of conflict?
Well, the crazy thing is here, this document was provided by the District Attorney Patterson to the defense during this, because the document came from the FBI. It's just so convoluted. So Judd never disclosed it. The defense counsel never disclosed it. But the district attorney disclosed it back to the defense counsel. It went right back to Marshall Judd, who did not tell his co-counsel and did not tell Greg. So it was like this little closed circle. So in a way, the prosecutor, I think, I don't know what I'm guessing he should have somehow disclosed it to the court. But he did disclose this document back to the defense counsel, probably thinking that both of the attorneys are going to get this, right? Nistat's going to get it and Judd's going to get it. But apparently only Judd got it back and didn't tell anybody. I have a question, though, Susan Collin. What about, like, in a situation where, like, because in this case, it's not like Greg and Dwayne, or as we called him, Dwayne, like, they had any conflict between themselves. They're not, like, testifying against each other, right? So, I mean, couldn't, if Judd had disclosed this to Greg, could then he have represented them both because they both have kind of similar interests?
Theoretically, there are some conflicts that you can, you know, make good by making sure all parties are aware. This one, I'm hesitant to say that would be enough to cure it, given that they're potentially just at odds. For instance, what if the prosecutor doesn't want that info getting out and gives a better deal to one of them if he doesn't give the info? And that'd be unethical from the prosecutor's point, but it'd also be unethical for the defense attorney to go along with it.
Right.
So it's possible that I wouldn't want to give a final answer here, but yeah, I would not rely just on informing both clients to be enough to get rid of the conflict.
Yeah, and so that's that. The model rule again, 1.7 has subsection B that says if a conflict does exist, you can inform both potential clients about the conflict. However, you have to have the belief that even if they agree to that, this conflict is not sort of something that makes it such that there's no way you can give diligent representation to both. And so as Susan is noting, you maybe could get a waiver, but in this case, it's kind of tough to see how the attorney would know ahead of time that this could be something that's reconcilable.
Right. Mm. And an attorney can't, in like good faith, represent their client in such a way that they know will lead to an appeal issue later, right? Like an attorney can't ethically say, I mean, if somebody thinks, you know, devil's advocate, maybe he knew this was going to be a problem and that it would be an issue that could be brought up on appeal. Like that's not something a lawyer can do either, right? Like intentionally make a mistake. I'm sure there's a law, a rule about that, that you also know the number to, right, Colin?
There's not even a rule or a particular number. It's just well recognized by precedent in case. You can't, as an attorney, do something with the goal of then creating an issue for your client to appeal.
Right.
You can preserve an issue for appeal. You can identify something and try and preserve it. Yeah. That's different. But you can't like intentionally do secret misconduct with the goal of having it found out one day.
But that happens all the time with Jack McCoy on Law and Order. All the time. He's always doing that. And I'm always like, Becca, how can he do that?
I hate to break it to you, but Law and Order is not realistic about the law.
There. Yes, it is. All right. So we need to talk about those gas cans. Because all throughout this season, we've been talking about the Red Herring Farm and the gas cans that were found there. And I have said repeatedly, I don't think those gas cans had anything to do with the Kolesnikow fire, but they were, you know, somehow tied to this whole story. Meanwhile, there were apparently two gas cans found at the victim's house, the red plastic one and the old metal one. And Peggy was somehow able to run across the street and take a gas can out of an investigator's hand and say, you can't have that. It's mine. Seriously?
So crazy. But it explains why we couldn't find any documentation or evidence of that metal looking gas. Like we have pictures, but there's just nothing else. It's never mentioned in the evidence logs. It's never like there's just poof, it's gone.
So the pictures were taken and then she took it and then they logged the evidence or something.
I guess so. And crazy thing is this investigator, he's standing, I mean, the pictures are on our website. He's standing above the gas can. He lowers something into it. He takes a sample from it. I mean, it's gas and puts it in like a little evidence box, like a paint box that he seals it in. And then he lets her just take the can from a scene of an arson.
Everyone's speechless. Colin, what are your thoughts?
I mean, listen, I'm kind of in the same boat as you the whole season. And I don't know how to make any sense of these gas cans and what's going on and what these witnesses are doing. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, one of the things that struck me as interesting around all the Peggy stuff, and I really think it comes into play around the shirt. Tell me if I have this wrong. So like multiple people during Peggy's meth-induced rantings after the murders heard her sort of ranting about leaving a shirt behind at the fire at the scene. Unbeknownst to any of these people, a shirt had been turned in and cataloged. So it wasn't like they were tying a piece of evidence they knew about and saying that
they had no idea.
Right. So that was those were independent things, right?
Completely.
We don't also, I mean, again, the problem is the lack of paperwork. And it's very odd, too, that the one place it was documented was for like the fire squad or whatever.
Well, but here's the thing, though. It might have been documented elsewhere, but we cannot get the TBI files. Putnam County has turned over like 10 pieces of paper. Like there's just we don't know where else it exists. But where one place it definitely didn't exist, it wasn't never disclosed. So defense counsel never did get it. We have defense files. It doesn't exist anywhere. And the family and Greg never knew this shirt would ever actually exist. Like they you know, in all of these statements, the shirt keeps coming up, but everybody just was like, I don't, you know, she was on meth. Who knows what she's ranting about? Nobody knew it actually was a real thing until 2015.
So is there any way to know whether or not the prosecution knew about the shirt, given that, I mean, you don't have, do you have those files?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I
don't think we can say for sure one way or another.
Yeah, we don't know for sure. We don't know for sure. I mean, Putnam County had it.
Yeah. I mean, if you were able to get, so wait a minute. You do know that, that somebody had that piece of evidence logged somewhere and the defense never saw it. I mean.
But it wasn't law enforcement agency that had it. Robbie, was the bomb squad? Was it?
No, it was Putnam County. Sergey Lebed turned it over to Putnam County. Putnam County are the ones who logged it. Mm. And then that was turned over. And the bomb and arson division had a copy of that receipt. Because like I said, Putnam County has given us nothing. They've given us very, very few documents. They keep saying this is all we have. Everything else was TBI. TBI is a vault. So, you know, we're lucky that bomb and arson's like, okay, well, here's our file. And this showed up in their file.
Why is TBI a vault? What's the deal with that?
Statutorily, they can't. They're just exempt from the public information request unless a court orders it.
So you can't FOIA the TBI for stuff? Nope. 'Cause you can FOIA the FBI for stuff. That's really surprising to me. Colin, why?
It's weird.
What is the
difference? State by state.
Yeah. I mean, so that's what it is. A state can institute a FOIA law around its own agencies.
Correct.
Hmm. It's like in Georgia, you cannot get anything from like the prisons because it's all state secret.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, there is a bunch of, you know, I know local legislation now. I see some of it bumbling up here in New Hampshire of, you know, this is like, I think a thematic thing that like people are working on at the local level to try to enact all these little local laws. And one of them here is that it's onerous to reply to these requests. And that should be the reason why, you know, some municipalities or law enforcement agencies shouldn't have to do it. But it's surprising to me because the TBI, I guess it doesn't surprise me, but it does at the same time.
The two things I never fail to grab when I am headed to the gym are, number one, my water bottle, full to the brim with ice water, and number two, one of my perfect snack bars. And I always have like at least a dozen of them in my fridge, if not more, but I just don't. I don't head to the gym until I have those two items because on the way to the gym, I nibble on the perfect snack bar because it gives me energy throughout my workout without making me feel full and gross. Now look, Perfect Snack products are the first of their kind. They keep refrigerated, fresh for optimal texture and taste. Look, I've never seen refrigerated protein bars before, but the thing about Perfect Snacks is you don't have to keep them in the fridge. They stay good for up to a week in, you know, outside of the fridge. And I do that too. I sometimes just keep a couple of them in my car. And they're also delicious. They've got flavors like dark chocolate peanut butter, almond butter, coconut peanut butter, which is my favorite. So you don't have to sacrifice taste for health. And they are so healthy. They've got up to 17 grams of whole food protein and 20 superfoods. And they just are combined to create this cookie dough-like texture that is as nutritious as it is delicious. I am telling you, not a day goes by that I do not eat a perfect snack. Every day. I have one every single day. I love them. And right now, Perfect Bar is offering you, all our listeners, 15% off your online order if you go to perfectbar.com/undisclosed. Shop their refrigerated snacks at perfectbar.com/undisclosed today to get 15% off your order. Make your day a little more perfect at perfectbar.com/undisclosed.
All right, so moving on, just a final thing on that, Colin. When I heard that whole part of the podcast, of course, having listened to many, many podcasts you guys have made, all I kept thinking, like, this whole time with this thing and other things was just like Brady, 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 right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the importance of it being with Putnam County is it doesn't matter whether it's the prosecutor's office that has it, as long as a governmental entity has this information, it's material, it's exculpatory, and it's not turned over to the defense, that could be grounds for a Brady violation.
Hmm. So what do we think about these statements? You know, Peggy's antique gas can and her snatching the gas can away from the scene investigators, which multiple people say happened. Her rants about the shirt, which multiple people say happened. Of course, all these people are known meth users. And so there's, you know, potentially some credibility issues there. But is there enough crossover, like comparative data you can do to show that if people didn't know and they were saying it anyway, or if people didn't have contact with each other and they were telling the same story. Is there any way to do some sort of analysis that kind of breaks through those credibility issues?
I mean, it's a fact finder's job to weigh all that.
Mm.
And the other option, of course, you always look for in witness statements is police contamination. And if the police did know about the shirt, I mean, one defense they'd probably raise is that, oh, we asked the witnesses about it. That's how they knew about it.
Hmm.
Of course, then they have to explain why they didn't tell the defense about it. But that is one way they can get out of the statements.
Hmm. All right. Well, Lacey Harness.
Wait, Robbie, isn't his middle name like Boy or something?
Yep.
Yeah, Lacey Boyd. Boy Harness.
No, it's B-O-Y-D, Boyd.
Boyd.
Oh,
okay.
That's right.
Or as I think, wasn't there another season that you guys did where the name Boyd was just like so ubiquitous, like it was just everywhere? Yeah, yeah, okay.
Watkins.
I've literally never met anybody named Boyd, but I think I've heard it 100 times on your podcast. So what is his deal? Why does he continue to talk? I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, Greg's mother's take is very kind of warm and kind to him. He's trying to do the right thing. You know, he doesn't want to, you know, go much, you know, longer, and he's willing to sort of give up more, and we should be appreciative. But at the same time, the episode is called The Man Who Knew Too Much, and that is the man you guys are talking about. Rabia, what do you think Lacey's deal is?
So I think Lacey feels a tremendous amount of guilt and pain for Greg. I think he feels a tremendous amount of guilt and pain for Joyce. He spent hours talking to Joyce. And to be honest, Joyce also feels very protective of him. She, you know, she met his children. He's not just raising his children. He's taking care of his, like, old mother who's got dementia. He's taking care of his sister's kids. So Joyce feels very protective of him and doesn't want him to get wrapped up in anything. And she's also incredibly thankful that he has spent so much time telling her what he knows. And he certainly, every time he's spoken to, seems to know more and more. I think he just has a lot of guilt. My sense is that, you know, we know, okay, the victims were killed. A bunch of the property was removed. I think Lacey might have had something to do with that part of it, retrieving stuff. I mean, Samantha did tell Billy that she saw her parents and Lacey with a bunch of stuff entering their house, like with a bunch of the Klusnik house items. So maybe Lacey was involved in that. He sat on the porch, kind of, you know, he talks about how he sat on the porch and watched the horns as they were in their van behind the Klusnik house for much of the day. And then later into the evening, almost like he was a lookout. So, and you know, Lacey himself was on, he was on meth at the time. And, or I mean, maybe not on that day, but generally speaking, he was, you know,
the reason he's hanging out with him.
Exactly.
With
that's exactly why and also because they kind of grew up with the horns. Yeah, they grew up with the horns. His father, Lacey's father, was Sam Horn's best friend for decades. And so I think Lacey knows what he knows because he probably was on the property for other reasons. I personally don't think he was involved in any violence. He just doesn't have any history like that. And I think if he had been involved like that, he probably would not want to say a word to Joyce. I mean, I don't know. That's my sense. It's just a theory.
Hmm. Susan, do you have a theory about Lacey and what's up with that guy?
No. I mean, there's definitely a few options that could explain what he's doing, but he is talking. So
I will say this, and this is not something we included. A number of times he did say to Joyce, hey, what are you trying to do here? You're not trying to take, are you trying to help your boy or are you trying to take someone else down?
Hmm.
So he's very concerned about this case getting reopened and other people, you know, getting charged with these murders.
Well, Lacey, don't worry about that because police never care.
Police never care.
Once there's an exoneration.
Right. Yeah, that is true. Even when somebody's exonerated, it's rare. It is rare for them to then reopen the case and pursue it.
Hmm.
Although I wonder, has there been a case? Actually, maybe not so. Maybe there have been cases where if the police, like, for example, There was DNA testing.
There's been a few DNA cases where it's been done, but other than that, almost never.
I think when you have a DNA case and they can absolutely positively identify the actual culprit, then yes, I have seen where charges have been brought.
Now, the only potential DNA in this case would be from the touch DNA, from like the flashlight batteries and so forth, right?
I don't know what's on that shirt.
Yeah.
There's a cord, the flag. I mean, I was speaking to the folks who might likely will potentially represent Greg, and they were talking about how, you know, flashlights like that, because of the rubber, the grooves and stuff, they can pick up a lot of like epithelial cells and things of that sort. So, there, you know, there's the actual gun. There's the actual gun. There's the flashlight. There's the batteries. There's the cord. There's the, and there's definitely the, there's these wire cutters that were found in the yard. They're, is the shirt. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that could be DNA tested, and every single piece of evidence should be DNA tested. Tennessee has a post-conviction DNA statute that would allow Greg to get back into court one way, even if the other appellate measure, like he can't, you know, qualify for procedural reasons for any of the other stuff. This could help get him back in court and open the door, by the way, to get the TBI file, and who knows what else is in there.
Colin, can you explain that DNA statute? Like, that some states have that and some don't, right?
Every state has some version of a post-conviction DNA statute. Some are extremely limited. They vary in burden of proof that you have to satisfy to get the testing. So it really is a wide variance among states, but every state has some version of a post-conviction DNA statute.
Folks, it is that time of the year when I am constantly freezing. I don't know what has happened with me, but every single year that goes by, I get colder and colder, and I was never like this. And it's hard because you have to manage your body temperature along with everybody else around you, right? People in your family who are like, no, I'm too hot, I'm too this. I mean, my son, my husband, and my 11-year-old run hot. So they're always hot, I'm always pumping up the heat. Anyhow, it's tough, but I have not had to do any of that anymore because since last year, I've been using the Ember Wave, and it's amazing. Ember Wave is the first bracelet that helps you feel colder or warmer at the press of a button. That's right, you heard it right. It almost seems like this technology should not exist. It sounds like it belongs in a sci-fi movie, but it's real. It actually exists. So you wear the Ember Wave on your wrist, and science shows that warming or cooling sensitive areas of your body, like your wrist, actually improves your overall comfort. It's almost like, imagine if you're freezing and you run your hands under warm water, right? It kind of makes you feel comfortable all over. So the Ember Wave cools or warms your wrist with precisely engineered thermal waves. They generate a perfect sensation that works with your body and mind to help you feel 5 degrees more comfortable in minutes. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there who like are stuck in frigid office spaces or in suffocating spaces when they go to work, and the Ember Wave is perfect for that because it's a small personal device. It's not going to be disruptive. You don't have to get permission from HR to have like a space heater in your office or whatever, or a fan. You can use this anywhere, whether you're at a restaurant, you're in public transit, or you're in your office. And it also makes a great gift for those of you who are looking for a unique holiday gift, especially for people who love gadgets. I actually am getting one for my father for his birthday, which is coming up just in a couple of weeks. The Ember Wave was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, and it's been reviewed by a number of leading technical publications like Wired, Fast Company, GMA, and for good reason, because it was invented by 3 MIT scientists who knew exactly what they were doing. So, to get your Ember Wave, listeners get $50 off for the holidays if they go to emberwave.com/undisclosed. That's emberwave.com/undisclosed. Check out the Ember Wave today and get $50 off again if you go to emberwave.com/undisclosed.
I was very curious to hear, as was a couple of listeners, including Courtney, who, you know, had some questions about the horns, Peggy and Samantha. I was curious to hear that you guys heard that they have been listening to the podcasts. I'm not going to ask you how you know that, probably just through some sources, right? Are you hoping that they will come forward after listening to this podcast with either some information or with something disputing something that you said that you can then work with? What is your hope there?
I mean, it's not like we're making them listen to it. If they're listening to it, they're listening to it. Of course, you would always hope that if they have information that could make a difference in this case, that they would come forward. Yeah, I mean, it's through some sources. I will say, I just want to mention something interesting that, you know how like, so as the series has been going on, every so often people will pop up and say, oh, about that episode, what you mentioned there, I know some more information about it. You remember the story in which Sam's brother was killed by Rose Redmond's nephew? You remember that story?
Yes.
Rebecca. And Rose went to prison for it, for killing Sam's brother, or helping kill Sam's brother or whatever, conspiring to kill him. Well, it turned out somebody contacted us, witness contacted us, and told us that apparently the only reason Rose actually, she had gone to the police. She had recorded her nephew basically confessing that he did it. And she went to the police, which was always an odd thing. I never understood why she did that. But according to this witness who was there at the time around the Horn family, Sam and Peggy had turned against her and said, "We know that you were behind this. We're going to make sure, like, you know," and they recorded her talking about the murder, and we're going to turn her in. So she thought, this is one way to protect myself. So apparently there is not great blood between there's some bad blood between Rose and her daughter and granddaughter, Samantha and Peggy. So you never know who will break, you know, eventually.
That's an interesting detail about them recording her. It strikes me that, like, that's a thing that people work with the police do. That's not a thing that people typically do on their own. You know what I mean? I don't know. Yeah. That's an interesting detail. Yeah.
But ever since then, there's been some bad blood between them.
I could imagine. Colin, yeah. If you did that to a member of your family, wouldn't you assume there'd be some bad blood after that?
I don't think Thanksgiving dinner would be that.
Now, Colin, Lisa asks this question. Listener Lisa, she says, "I listen on my way home from school tonight." And she is a law student, apparently. She wants to know more about what is next for Greg legally and how the podcast or what you guys have uncovered could help. Now, you guys talked about this in the last episode. Colin, do you have any thoughts about that? And then I'll ask the rest of the panel.
Yeah, well, you know, as we mentioned in the episode, there's this Tennessee law firm and Innocence Project who are interested in getting involved. And so, you know, one option is the post-conviction DNA testing statute that can be done. Brady claims, although we're seeing some question marks in the Joy Watkins case out of Georgia, theoretically, Brady claims are something that you can bring even decades later if it's something you were not aware of, and that's still viable. There's successor habeas petitions where if you have new evidence or claims, including evidence pointing to alternate suspects, that is something you can petition the court to get back into court. So there are a variety of different legal options that, depending upon exactly what exists here, could be explored as a next step in the case.
And right now, the folks that I'm talking to who, you know, I think will probably be representing Greg, they've kind of come up with a 3-pronged strategy, which I can't really discuss yet, but it does involve some of what Colin's saying, but also some other avenues that might still exist. So I think, you know, unlike some of the other cases, Greg does have more options than some of the folks whose cases we've covered. One thing I was curious about, Colin, do you and Susan, the information that Lacey has given us in the, like, fairly recently, in the last 6 months, would any of that rise to the level of, like, new evidence?
Yeah, oh. I'm thinking it's harder with the witness statements like that.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Because I don't think so, because Lacey was always in the record. Like, it's not like he's someone that couldn't have been talked to.
Right.
But if he wasn't giving more information at the time, then what can you do with that? I mean, wouldn't you say that was due diligence, that he had been spoken to again
maybe,
and again?
Maybe. I think it's – I don't think there's an easy answer for that one.
Mm. Yeah, it's very much in the gray zone there, gray area, as to whether that would be new and could allow for reopening the case.
Hmm. But if the case were reopened and there were a new trial, he's a potential defense witness.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Right.
Sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know. Would you be able to use the recordings of him in court? I mean, do you guys think that the material that you guys have put together here could be used in an appeal process or in a court case at some point? And do you plan, I'm curious to know about your process, the person who's going to be representing or people who are representing Greg now, would you work with them and give them the stuff that you guys have compiled?
Well, ideally, you wouldn't need any of that, because ideally you have the witness willing to testify themselves and showing up on the stand. So if everything works out, like, the ideal way, that the recordings are meaningless.
Right.
The question is, what happens if, say, the witness is no longer available or is no longer cooperating?
Right. Okay. A lot of listeners were curious about the storyline, sort of post Greg's conviction. You guys kind of got into it in the podcast about his personal life. And we heard about that really heartbreaking situation with Becky and her death and her difficult relationships after he was incarcerated. And a bunch of listeners, including Toby, want to know whether or not Greg has any contact with his daughter today, how she's doing. If you know anything about that and you can say anything about that at all, he and others would like to know. And if you can't, I think I understand why.
No, I mean, like, Greg has always maintained a close relationship with his daughter, Rebecca, and Rebecca is in constant communication with him. When I was looking at one of the, around the time right after Becky's death, when Greg was fighting from behind bars to keep his parental rights, he submitted along with his, I can't remember if it was like a response to a petition or a letter to the Child Protective Services or whatever, a log of the prison visits where in the last, like in the previous 2 years, Rebecca had visited him 199 times. Wow. In the prison. So he's, he did his best to help even, fund her as she went to college. And, Rebecca's doing, she's doing as well as she can. She's basically been raised by her grandparents, but she's an adult now and she's a lovely young human being. They're very close.
Isn't that unusual? I mean, he has been in prison her whole life and yep. They've maintained a relationship this whole time. That seems very unusual.
That was his commitment. I mean, that's like his heart and soul, Rebecca.
Now, Stephen asked a question, and I just want to give you guys a chance to clear it up because I know what the intentions were because I read the script. There was a reference in the last episode to, Greg's, quote, infidelity, and Stephen is asking again just to confirm that we all understand and that this podcast understands that infidelity isn't necessarily, non-monogamy is not necessarily infidelity and so forth, and that they seem to have an understanding of sorts. So can we just say that we all understand that? Or does anybody on this panel not agree with that? Because I think that the podcast made that clear, right?
Yeah, we get that. I guess it's an easy shorthand word.
I was for a second, I was trying to think what the issue was, and I did realize it. It's a good point, but
isn't it more about the jury's potential perception, though, than it is about, I mean, that to me was how this has always been framed. Like, Greg can say that he and Becky had an agreement.
It's about perception.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly right. In scripting this, that's how, and maybe it wasn't phrased well, but that was kind of the point, is like, despite what the perception of that whole thing might have been, which was the perception, the negative perception would have been infidelity, the reality was that, his marriage to Becky was not just a marriage of convenience at the time.
Is there anything else that any of you would like to add? Final thoughts summing up the series and where we left it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that couldn't be included for different reasons. Just, again, there's so many people whose names pop up in the cases that are, a lot of them are kind of interesting details, but also I didn't want to keep being redundant. And how many names can you expect listeners to remember? it's like, oh, one more person who said Sam was a crazy killer. Oh, there's another person who said Sam was a crazy killer. I mean, like, there's just so many of them. Well, I'm kind of excited now because I feel like now that the reporting's been done, the investigation, as far as I'm concerned, is not over. We have some new leads that we're going to be looking at in the next couple of months. So I'll be back in Cookeville, Tennessee for that at some point. And I think there's potentially new evidence that still exists. And I think there's other people that might come forward too as this goes on. But I'm excited to see all of this kind of come to fruition in court, just getting him back in court somehow. And let's see, Greg just recently had a birthday. So happy birthday, Greg. And would it be terrible if I said hello to Pam and Peggy and Samantha?
No. Hi, guys.
That would be terrible.
We heard you're listening. If you have anything you'd like to say, send us a note. We'd love to hear it. So, Colin and Susan, we heard Robbie say at the end of this episode this week that you guys are going on your annual hiatus and that you're sort of regrouping for a series of stories and episodes you're working on next year. Is there anything that you can tell me and listeners about what you're working on, if not in substance, at least in spirit, so that I know that what I will be looking forward to?
I'm always so bad at answering these questions without like giving away too much.
Can't you just tell us like the theme? Is there a theme we should be looking forward to, if not like a specific name? What's going to outrage us next time we hear from you?
Everything. It's a crazy ass case.
Colin, what about you?
How about this? It'll be closer to home.
Oh. Okay. What about you, Colin? Is there anything you're looking forward to telling us about in the upcoming year?
Yeah, well, even before we get to next year, we have one more special episode that'll be coming out soon. It's about a man who, this is another Philadelphia case. It's a murder in Philadelphia with a bunch of alibi witnesses, and he has a hearing before the Board of Pardon on December 20th. So we'll learn about his case. And then into 2020, we'll return to Pennsylvania again. There's yet another Pennsylvania case that we become involved with that we think is just as strong as the cases that have led to exoneration. So we'll be back to the Keystone State in 2020.
And in 2020, we should be awaiting a result from the Supreme Court of Georgia for Joey's case. Mm-hmm. And fingers crossed, another hearing for his habeas, as well as a hearing for Dennis Perry's case down in South Georgia.
And Robbie, all you've got to add is that we should look forward to something closer to home, huh?
Well, we gave a little bit of a teaser at the end of last week's episode, but yeah, a little bit closer to home. And then I'll add that we will probably be seeing some new movement in Adnan's case in the next year, too.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you guys do. I am a huge fan of your work in addition to helping you work on it. And I can't thank you all enough for letting me host the addendum for the Greg Lance case. It has been a ride and a journey, and some weekends producing the show have been...
Rebecca, you're an awesome
host.
You're
a beast.
Well, you're a beast. You've been amazing.
It's a lot.
Thank you.
It's a lot. And I just really want to commend you guys. I remember seeing you in Tennessee, you know, wearing your disguises as you came back from these interviews. And I remember listening, but I remember because it was like near the beginning of your reporting and you were thinking like, I don't know. You said, you know, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know. And all the things that you've come up with since then, it's been really impressive to work on and to listen to. So thank you all for including me and your team for yet another year. It's been really, really fun and quite the journey.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners, too.
Yes. Thanks to all of you. Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lance series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod now and all through 2020. And you can ask questions for future episodes on Twitter and Facebook. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum about any case this team has done that interests you. Remember, the sponsors of Undisclosed make it possible for this team to continue doing their great work. So please support all the sponsors you hear about on this show and on regular episodes of Undisclosed and buy their stuff. Our executive producer is the wonderful Methil Telhan. Audio production for the addendum is done by the brilliant Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song is by Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture review podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. As you can hear, I'm a big fan of that franchise. Special thanks to my partner in crime and my partner in life, Kevin Flynn, for picking up some of my slack so I could host this series. Also, thanks to Robbie, Susan, and Colin, who continue to make Undisclosed a dream come true in my podcasting work life. This series and these addendum episodes have been really fun to produce and super fun to host. And thanks for all the listeners who've sent me feedback about my questions, my theories, and my hosting. On behalf of everyone Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back soon and then again in 2020.
And you're still following what's going on in Reddit. I don't even look there anymore. It's so awful.
I check in from time to time, and this seemed especially juicy, so I wanted to pass
what's
it along.
What's going on? What
can you hear me?
What did I miss on Reddit?
There's this guy in Reddit who says he's writing a book about the case, and he's been talking with Jay for the past few years. And
like
Jay
years.
Has like his 87th new version of this story that completely changes all the prior facts. I don't know whether...
But it still implicates Adnan.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's just completely different in terms of when things happened, where they happened, everything.
So it must be in the Serial podcast origins thread.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those guys.
Oh, my God. How are they? They're still talking about phone records and timelines. How do they have the stamina for this? Like, I don't even have the energy for it anymore. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. It's crazy.